This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
By popular demand, Place to Be Nation Wrestling returns to the Dirty South for Talkin' WCW, an episodic wrestler showcase designed to educate, evaluate, and entertain, with matches spanning the intimate stage of Techwood Studios to the heights of Space Mountain. Talkin' WCW presents the best, worst, and most surreal offerings from World Championship Wrestling. So cast your gaze to the Turnertron with hosts Jennifer Smith, Tim Capel, and Greg Phillips.
Hi, welcome to Talkin' WCW. My name is Jennifer Smith. I am here with the American to my bash. Tim Capel, how you doing, Tim?
Hey, at least I'm not great.
Neither one of us are great. So we should
not make that mistake going into this podcast ever, right? But we do have someone who is great, and that is the man in our third seat, Greg Phillips. Greg, how you doing?
Well, I was going to settle for the. I was going to be the.
No, you're clearly the great out of the three of us.
We don't use definite articles around here. It's just Great American Bash.
I'm doing all right. I'm excited to talk about the WCW again. Mm-hmm. And happy you guys are gathered here with us in the fictional studio as we talk about our a summer tradition like none other, or actually like several others, but you know, like none other in wrestling.
Yeah, well, that is true, and this was my pick for this episode, and I thought instead of doing a wrestler, we hadn't done like a theme or a concept in a while, and given that it is the dog days of summer, now that we're finding ourselves in here, especially in the South, that we'd throw it to an old WCW tradition and do all Great American Bash matches for our podcast represented here tonight. And, you know, we've previously discussed some Great American Bash matches. I did some research, you guys, and you want to know what those were, those matches previously discussed. Mm-hmm. I'll lay them out for you. We did... of course, on our Kevin Sullivan episode, the legendary brawl in the women's bathroom,
Chris
Benoit versus Kevin Sullivan.
Who, by the way, I understand that you can see Kevin Sullivan in Black Widow as one of the villains in the new movie this summer. So,
Taskmaster, yes. So, yes, definitely has gone to the silver screen now in the MCU. Big step up for Mr. Sullivan there. That, of course, from Great American Bash 1996. Also, from that same edition of the Bash, we had Sting versus Lord Steven Regal. Mm. That was from our Sting episode. Now, we prior to that, Great American Bash 95, Ric Flair versus Randy Savage, we talked about on the Randy Savage episode of the podcast. So those are the three that I came up with. We might have done more. I don't think so. But do go ahead and track those down if you're so inclined. If you want to have a double feature of Great American Bash action, you'll find those. But anyway, this is a summertime event. What are you going to say, Jenny?
I was just going to ask, do you guys find yourself going back to watch any, like, you know, of these shows, like you would a Mania or something? When it comes to Mania season, do you go, it's summer, I need to watch a Bash?
Kind of just depends for me. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I mean, more so in the summer. Mm-hmm. I just associate, like, WCW, it doesn't have, like, its WrestleMania, you know?
Right.
Where, I mean, I guess you could say, well, Starrcade is their WrestleMania, but it's, I don't know, it's kind of not... You know, yeah. Especially in later years where it got de-emphasized, and probably Havoc was considered their biggest show, the biggest event of the year, where they had their kind of biggest mm-hmm. money matches. They might save something for Starrcade if they thought they could make more money, but by and large, I think Havoc was the more stacked show. So it's sort of tricky. It just the way that WCW and their branding was never on par with the WWF, where it's like, oh, it's Mania season now. We're going to watch a whole bunch of WrestleManias.
Right.
Yeah.
But when I get into summertime, I do find myself wanting to watch, if anything, from WCW, stuff like Bash at the Beach or,
right.
again, Great American Bash. If not entire shows, then matches, certainly. So kind of put me in the mood.
Yeah, it's kind of different. It's kind of weird for me because I don't really ever get like I got to watch a line of Bash, but there's certain matches I feel like going back and watching sometimes. And then what happens is if we start watching a match for the show, I'll end up oftentimes watching the entire show just because I'm like, you know, I'm into it. I'm kind of like, mm-hmm. oh, I want to see what happens next and keep going there. But I don't know if you felt the same way, Tim, but I always felt like as a kid, well, maybe subconsciously, but really I always kind of felt like WCW owned the summer. Like the WWF got all the attention most of the rest of the year, but the summer, May, well, especially like end of May through SummerSlam, I always felt like WCW just had the most stuff going on. Like whether it was, you know, the NWO and Bash at the Beach, Great American Bash, Sting won the title from Flair, which is why it was always my favorite WCW pay-per-view, because I always associated it with that 1990 memory of Sting beating Flair for the title. And then, you know, big things happen. You know, we'll talk about one later that happens, a major title change in 92, a major title change in 91, a major title change in 90. You know, 89 being one of the great shows in the NWA era. And then you go into even the late 90s, you know, 95, not so much, but 96, of course, has the Outsiders power bombing Eric Bischoff off the stage. 97 had a, you know, the DDP and Macho Man feud coming to a head. And
it's just a great card.
Oh, yeah.
Looking at that 97 show.
And so I always felt like, you know, WCW for a few months every summer kind of had the full attention. Because WWF would, on the other hand, often have these sort of middling King of the Ring shows and
right,
stuff like that. That, you know, I think back to the Mabel years and even like that summer, like of like 96, when you'd have on one channel the Body Donnas versus the Smoking Guns, and then on the other channel you've got like the Outsiders coming out and beating people up with lead pipes. So it's like,
right,
it was an easy choice as a kid. So anyway, Great American Bash has always had a special place in my heart, and I'm glad that we revisited this, which I consider to be the most quintessential WCW pay-per-view.
I'll tell you something I noticed. Of course, Great American Bash, the inaugural event was July 6, 1985, the Supercard, Charlotte, North Carolina, brought it back as a touring show in July and August. So to your point, Greg, how they kind of would own that summer, just having this big, you know, come see not just our big live events, but we're calling it the Great American Bash, you know, springing from the mind of Dusty Rhodes, of course. So that was 86 and 87 summer for WCW. And finally, it debuts as a proper pay-per-view on July 10th, 1988, in a show that I thought was, I think it's a pretty underrated pay-per-view, honestly. And that's from the Baltimore Arena, sort of the what's going to become the kind of main stomping grounds for Great American Bash, in a city I love so much. But back in the day on the old school WWF network, which is a great service that used to exist, you guys, for Americans, it no longer does. You could watch those 86 and I believe even 87 live touring versions of the Bash. Now, I don't see those on the Peacock anymore. It just starts with 88.
So, brother, I don't know how to find anything on Peacock anymore.
Yeah.
I can't. It took me forever even to figure out how to get to the WCW pay-per-view section. And I figured that out. But then, like, you know, all this cool, like you said, the touring versions of the Bash, the mm-hmm. any of the Hidden Gems content that was mm-hmm. on the network, I can't find. And it's frustrating, and I don't like it. And Peacock should give me better service.
Yeah, I just wonder if they're really and truly going to have all the content from the old network. How are they going to work that in? We've got seasons now, you guys. They've already started from season one. Where are we going to slot 1987 Bashin as season zero?
Season zero, yeah.
Is 86 a season negative one? What are we doing?
I mean, you got to say though, 2000 was a great season finale for Starrcade.
Well.
Perfect.
Yeah, series
to wrap
finale.
The season up. Series finale. Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to say they actually had two of those touring shows from 86. Because I remember watching some stuff as part of the greatest WCW match.
Wasn't
ever
one of them? Wasn't one of those the one that had Flair versus Ricky Morton?
Yes, that was 80. That was one of the 86. Yeah,
I knew this because they Turner Home Entertainment used to package those summer tours into a 2-hour VHS release. Mm-hmm. And so, if you went to Blockbuster or certain mom and pop movie stores in the early 90s, you could often find in the wrestling section, at least around where I was, those mid to late 80s Crockett Promotions and or later on, Turner Home Entertainment VHS okay. releases of those Great American Bash tours. So it may have been actually under the Crockett banner. I can't remember, but it was like you would buy it and it would have like edits of all these highlight matches from the tour. But Flair and Ricky Morton was one of them that was on there. I think there may have been one that was Ric Flair versus Nikita Koloff on one, maybe. I can't recall. But anyway, it was pretty cool.
Mm, yeah. You know, you got your first War Games matches taking place on these tours as well. I remember 87 from the old War Games playlist on the reel back in the original days of the network. You could watch that. I think that kind of disappeared at some point when they got rid of the playlists even. So all that is to say, we didn't have maybe as many options as we used to, as I say, grumbling, going into this episode. But we still had a lot of classic matches to choose from. Greg, of course, mentioned that 1989 edition of the show, regarded as one of the all-time great pay-per-views of really any promotion. Mm-hmm. And that's going to bring us to our first match that was selected for discussion tonight. And I think this one was yours, wasn't it, Greg?
That is correct. I actually audibled from my original mm-hmm. selection.
That's right.
For this show.
Sadly, as it turns out.
Sadly, that's shit. Well,
spoilers.
We'll have to get into what your first choice.
I have a feeling I know what your complaint will be with this match. But
all right, let's talk it out, bro.
nonetheless, let me explain to you the scenario. So I was running out of time to come up with I thought I was running out of time to come up with a selection for the show. And so I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to go with Ric Flair versus Terry Funk for the World Heavyweight Championship of Wrestling in 1989, because that's always been my favorite of the two major Flair Funk matches. I think it's actually a lot better than the I Quit match that people talk about more. And
a lot of people feel that way. Yeah.
It's just a badass match. One of my favorite Ric Flair performances. But because of Peacock's incompetence and the fact that you can no longer sort match by match, guys. You can no longer True. Just go to the little dot and watch the match that you might want to watch on a show. You have to do like you did back in the old days of VHS and just hope that you stumble upon the match that you're looking for somewhere on the runtime of the show. So there I am fast forwarding through this Great American Bash show. I end up watching a lot of it because it's, you know, I'm fascinated by so many of the hairstyles and the whatnot. And so I'm going through and it's like, oh, that's interesting. And then I come across this match and I'm like, well, you know what? I haven't seen this match gosh, I don't remember ever seeing it. I'm sure I saw it when I was a real little kid watching the VHS tape at some point, but I don't remember anything about the match. I've watched Muta and Sting a bunch. I've watched the War Games a few times, and I've watched, of course, Flair and Funk a bunch, but I don't remember this match very well, except that it's somewhat well-regarded. So I started watching it, and this was like late at night. It was about 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and I just got absolutely absorbed into this. This match just blew my – knocked my socks off, whatever expression you want to use. And so I instantly went into the group chat afterwards, and I said, guys, I'm changing my pick. No longer is it going to be Flair and Funk. I'm going with the total package, Lex Luger. Jenny's favorite wrestler and human being.
Yes, coming off the heels of our Lex Luger episode.
Defending, purely coincidence, defending his United States Championship against Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, beloved hero to all and family man above all else.
Yeah. Yeah. Jenny, didn't you say that you watched this as consideration for that Lex Luger episode we just did? You were considering it, maybe?
I mean, it was recommended to me. And then I had watched it, and then I was like, nah.
Well, I don't know that it's... It's maybe not the most representative Lex Luger match. While it is, I think, a very good match that does come up in recommendations a lot, it maybe feels like more of a Steamboat kind of match.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But Greg, get into it, if you will.
Sure. Yeah. So, I picked this match because it blew me away. Like, it really absorbed me into the match in a way that a wrestling match hasn't as much recently. Even though I've seen some real good wrestling matches, but this just, like, I was getting into this because it totally surprised me on account of its. To your point, it's different from really any of the Luger matches that we reviewed in our last show. Luger had just turned heel. He was a freshly minted heel champion at this point who had turned on Ricky the Dragon Steamboat out of jealousy and anger over Steamboat's placement in the rankings and the fact that Luger should be the number one contender for the World Heavyweight Championship in his mind. And he was angry that he was getting passed over by guys like Ricky Steamboat and as he called him in an interview segment on Saturday night, Terry Fuck. And Luger is angry. He turns on Steamboat. He beats him down with a steel chair. And it sets up what is supposed to be a no disqualification match here in front of a raucous crowd in Baltimore. And we start out as Ricky the Dragon Steamboat comes down to the ring. And yes, I'm going to refer to him by his full name with nickname as if I'm in classic TNA wrestling. Sweet. And he comes out with holding what appears to be a Komodo dragon with its mouth wired shut.
Yeah.
And a little vest on and everything.
The little leather vest. What's that?
And
leather
and,
daddy. Lizard.
Leather daddy Komodo dragon. Yeah. And his wife and Bonnie, of course, and his young son are with him, and the crowd's just not blown away by this presentation, shall we say? They come down to the ring, and he's a family man, and people are not enamored with this entrance. And this was sort of a common occurrence for Mr. Steamboat that year in '89, from what I have observed on pay per view events that year, that he tended to not be the favorite of the live audience, even though he was presented as a babyface. And of course, he was one of the best ever at during the course of a match turning people into his favor and getting them on his side. But certainly, it would appear to be an uphill struggle as we begin here. At this point, we have the total package's entrance, and he just looks like a $1 million. He comes out, looks like a megastar, but he gets in the ring and he starts complaining. And he says, look, I never wanted no stinking no DQ match. I don't want that. I want a regular match. And if I'll take my belt and I'll walk out of here if you don't adhere to my demands. And Gary Juster, a rare Gary Juster sighting, who was a promoter at the time, and he comes in and he's arguing with Luger. And Luger says, no, I'm not going to do the match. I won't have it. and he's about to leave, and then Juster talks to Steamboat, and Steamboat says, ah, screw it, let's give in to his demands, and we'll do a regular match. So it's turned into a as Gary Michael Capetta calls it, a regular rules match. And
just forget about that extra ring right beside it. Don't even worry about that part.
Yeah, I don't even know why I thought that was so funny when he said it, but it just sounded so unprofessional. It is funny. I guess there's no other way to say it, but it just sounds so unprofessional. Regular rules match.
Regular rules.
But anyway, so they proceed to have a barn burner of an opening segment. And here's what I think got me into this match. I was not prepared for Lex Luger to move and bump around as much as he did. So when this match starts, Steamboat is just all over him. We're talking hip tosses. We're talking a big back body drop out of the corner. These are moves that you didn't see Lex Luger take a lot. Because of his body build, his physique and everything, you didn't see Luger taking a lot of monkey flips and hip tosses and flying all over the ring for his opponents. But he is here. He's motivated here. He's flying around and the crowd's into the action. Steamboat's just lighting him up with these vicious chops. And what I liked about it is Steamboat's giving these vicious chops and Luger is still, even though he's a heel, he's still kind of doing that babyface thing where chopping Luger's pecs is a losing game because like every time he chops Luger like barely registers it. And then as the match progresses and as it gets harder and harder, then he starts selling it when they get outside the ring. Steamboat's throwing them all over the place. And of course, Luger as the heel eventually takes advantage of an opportunity and takes over and has a nice long heat segment on Steamboat where he's, I say long, but this match is really all action. Like there's no holds. Mm-hmm. Like Luger, every time I think Luger's about to grab a chin lock or put him in a bear hug or something, it's another spot. It's another move. It's constant movement. And Steamboat is selling his ass off here, looking like he's just getting, at this point, after Steamboat's early start, it looks like Lex Luger has taken over. And from sports terminology, this match is turning into a blowout. Like Luger is just dominating him. And my favorite point in the match is at one point Steamboat gets kind of a fluke roll up and Luger kicks out, and when they both pop up to their feet, an angry Luger levels Steamboat with a clothesline and Steamboat pops right back up and Luger levels him with another clothesline. Like this is like a babyface clothesline and a heel, and Steamboat pops up again and gets level with another clothesline, and then Steamboat pops up again and he starts wildly flailing these punches at nobody and misses completely. Yeah. Like a Terry Funk spot, and he, but it's almost like this baby face valiantly fighting to try to take another swing, but he's out of it and he falls out of the ring. My favorite part in the match, I thought that was just awesome from Steamboat, and Luger of course is talking trash the whole time. Jim Ross on commentary is very upset at the vocal minority of people who are cheering for Lex Luger in this match. He calls them hypocrites because Lex Luger has made fun of the people that cheer for him. And nonetheless, we get into a real nice sequence there. And it sets up, this match goes, I didn't time it out, but I think it's around the 12-minute mark, maybe 10 to 12 minutes, somewhere in there. Doesn't outstay its welcome. It's yep. All action. And eventually, the referee gets, distracted or something. And Luger goes outside the ring and grabs a steel chair. And he gets in there. That's what I remember what started this whole deal, the rivalry mm-hmm. between them. Mm-hmm. And Luger grabs the chair, and he's going to hit Steamboat and just go ahead and get disqualified because he doesn't care. He gets to keep the title. And then Steamboat sweeps his legs out from under him and then sets him up for the catapult. I love it. It's a great spot. But my favorite part, Luger positioning the chair perfectly over
yes.
his face
yes.
while he lays there as Steamboat gets him ready for the catapult. And Steamboat, of course, gives him the catapult. As Luger goes flying into the turnbuckle, smashes his own face into the chair, the crowd goes nuts. Even the people that were chanting for Luger earlier, now they're on Steamboat's side, and they just blow the roof off the place. They're ready to explode, and Steamboat grabs the chair, and he's pissed off, and he's holding the chair up, and the fans are going wild, and the ref tries to stop him. Tommy Young. And Ricky Steamboat shoves Tommy Young to the ground in an uncharacteristic rage. And then he goes to just waylaying Lex Luger and wearing his title ass out with steel chair shots to unfortunately get himself disqualified. And obviously a disqualification is not the ideal ending to a match like this. Crowd's not happy with that, but he's tearing Luger up with the chair. Luger's begging for mercy. And Steamboat eventually chases Luger all the way to the back with the steel chair. Although still the United States heavyweight champion, the total package, Lex Luger. Now, I will go ahead and acknowledge, I thought this match was on its way to being, and honestly, as far as the actual content of the match, this might have been my favorite Lex Luger match I've ever seen in terms of just pure ring work. I thought he was outstanding. And then the finish came, and I can't defend the finish. It's a stupid, bad finish to do on pay-per-view. But, you know.
It is, but it also, I think, does the job of putting over Luger's craftiness as a heel and getting that no disqualification stip waived. You know, basically that backfires on Steamboat.
Totally backfires on Steamboat. Because
if he had gone in under the original match design, I guess he could have done this and wore Luger's titled AFL with the chair and gotten the win. But that's not going to fly because, you know, Luger's the heel. He's gonna be a pussy about it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess it's also a callback to just this feud of how we, which I didn't know much of that backstory, so I appreciated that walk down memory lane, Greg. You did a much better job than our commentators did of getting, of laying that out, because I was sort of like, well, Steamboat looks like a real dumbass here.
Yeah,
is doing a very non-Steamboat sort of thing here and healing it up with the chair, attacking a guy, but knowing that it's really like some comeuppance for what had happened earlier, I'm like, okay, that tells a decent story.
Our announcers, of course, good old JR Jim Ross and Bob Caudle.
Bob Caudle, yes.
The soothing voice of Bob Caudle. But yeah, I can see that. I just feel like, and I think it's also, if I were watching it live at the time, I wouldn't have that big a problem with it, honestly, because I would think, okay, they're going somewhere with this story. But unfortunately, in real life, Steamboat was gone from the NWA thereafter, and we never actually got any kind of follow-up to this feud. So that was it. This was pretty much the end of it.
Really?
But, yeah, Steamboat left over money, I think, that summer, and he wouldn't return to WCW / the NWA until 1991.
I think I really enjoyed just the in-ring portion, just like you said, bell-to-bell action, really. Which, I mean, you definitely don't associate with a Lex Luger match. And I like how it was kind of focused on Ricky Steamboat not being able to match power with Luger.
Yes.
But he can rely on his technical savvy, his skill, his quickness to hang in there nonetheless. And there's not really any long heat segments or anything on Ricky Steamboat here that you might expect. So I sort of appreciated that aspect of it. If anything, two issues. I could have just used some more of this match before they did go into that kind of crappy finish. Like if they had, I don't know, maybe give me some more near falls, you know, by Steamboat, because that would have resolved my second issue, which is that I don't think that they just put over Steamboat's desperation and frustration enough to really get me to that place where I can see him grabbing a chair and going to town on Luger. Like, I needed
I would agree with that
frustration.
Yeah, that thought also occurred to me on the finish, is it did feel like they had not yet built enough to get that level of anger out of Steamboat, because Luger had not really done anything to him yet. He was just threatening to. Mm-hmm. Like, if Luger had, like, knocked the referee down or something, or if Luger had, like, behind the referee's back, maybe jabbed Steamboat in the gut with a chair at some point or something. But I think the fact that, you know, he hadn't really done anything to that point, and then it's Steamboat, of all people, that shoves the referee down first. But I will say this too, though. On the other hand, I think one of the complaints about Ricky Steamboat that I've had in the past in this run is he comes off as so milquetoast and so, like, such a good guy, like, such a bland sort of, you know, no passion having good guy. Not no passion. He's obviously passionate, but like he's just a guy that he's just a good guy. That's his whole character. I thought it was neat to see like a different element to Ricky Steamboat where he does get pissed off. And yeah, he doesn't always do the right thing because, you know, he shouldn't have hit Tommy Young, but by God, he was in his way and he wanted to get his revenge on Lex Luger. So I did appreciate that aspect of it. But to your point, I think maybe an extra minute, it wouldn't have taken much. I think that the length was pretty close to the right length on this match, but maybe like two more minutes of in-ring action. Like you said, you know, some of those patented Steamboat roll-ups and cradles would have been nice. So that's a good point.
All right. So it was just like, y'all are talking about being like surprised with some of the moves that Steamboat got on Lex. It was just nonstop chops though. Like, and they're good, but like every time he would do something cool, he would just do like 40 chops to like, and that's why you felt like there was nonstop action in the match is because there were just chops just all the time. And so like, that's fine. And like, in a way of making you feel like there's action happening, but it's just like very repetitive, like fall out of the ring, chase dude around ring, chop, chop, you know. And like you said, he's not really selling them. I mean, he kind of does towards the end, but, you know, we're not getting like those, like a satisfying, like, reaction from the chops.
Well, like for contrast, when Flair chops mm-hmm. Terry Funk and Funk falls over the guardrail mm-hmm. as a result of the chop, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah. So
that's
just
the extreme, yeah.
Right. and then I think that Lex from the beginning saying we're not gonna have the DQs, I'm like, okay, well, I pretty much know how this is gonna go.
Right,
like,
you're right. It telegraphed it.
Yeah, quite. I just feel like that should have been like not a thing. Like, don't even make it on there, and then just make it be a regular match, you know? Because then the DQ might be surprising. But if you're gonna do it this way, it's not at all surprising. The only thing I will say that I did enjoy was the end when Steamboat lost it, because I do like seeing that. But you guys are right, there was not enough build to that. I mean, like, Lex gets the chair, he fucks his own self up with the chair, which was great.
I'm a sucker anytime the heel does that. Yeah, anytime the heel hits himself with the chair, it's tremendous.
Yeah, me too. But he was, and you pretty much like hear them talking to each other, which, I mean, Lex is just very loud. And
I'm gonna turn around so you can hit me with the chair.
Chair. So maybe if we had done something in between, or after like the chair thing, and then when Steamboat loses it, you know, if there had been like one or two things there to make him lose it, that might have been a little bit better. But, you know, Steamboat's amazing. I mean, confusing a bit because, you know, if a guy comes out to the ring with like 12 guys carrying you on a random piece of wood, carrying a wild animal, I mean, I just feel like that's confusing.
It was a very, I mean, Tim, I was telling Jenny before we started recording, it was a very heel entrance for Steamboat in a lot of ways.
Except for the wife and kid. So I'm like,
yeah.
I think it's a really cool entrance, except for the wife and kids. Like,
exactly.
Nobody wants to see his asshole wife and his asshole kid. Like, get them out of here. Have him come out. Because it almost looks like he's floating to the ring because they shoot it from kind of a high angle. So you don't see that he's like being carried out.
I just associated it with the Macho King always being carried out. And like,
sure,
always felt bad for those dudes carrying him out. Like, what an asshole that's making other human beings carry him to the ring.
But
he's Ramses
style, you know, there's some pop to his otherwise very one-dimensional character to have this really cool entrance. I mean, even the Komodo Dragon, which, you know, is the type of thing you wouldn't really see today, but
no.
I wish he had stumbled upon the fire breathing thing around that time.
Yeah,
that would have been cool.
Oh God.
So, yeah, I mean, I like all that stuff, and I like that he, again, shows some more dimensionality if that's a word, at the end of the match with the chair coming into play. If anything, I sort of thought the shenanigans at the beginning were setting you up to think, okay, well, Luger is now going to get himself intentionally disqualified as the heel, especially against somebody like Ricky Steamboat, who would never resort to bludgeoning his opponent with a steel chair. So that, I mean, they definitely kind of subvert, even in tipping their hand, they still sort of subvert what exactly is going to happen in this finish here. And I like that. And even the stuff with the referee, it was very subtle in the match where I think at one point, amidst the flurry of 10 million chops, points out, like, Tommy Young actually physically intervenes, stops the chops. Yeah. And it's like, how dare you?
Well, yeah, that spot is so brilliant, because what happens is Steamboat gets him in the corner and he's unloading with chops and chops and chops. Mm-hmm. And then he pulls back to use his fist. He's going to throw a punch. And that's why Tommy Young grabs his fist to hold him back. But while Tommy Young grabs his fist and is distracted, Luger comes over the top and waylays Steamboat with a right hand.
Mm-hmm. Sucker punch.
And yeah, sucker punch. That was a really smart spot to throw in there.
So if you'd seen more of that, and I know wrestling can be criticized for being very, like, unsubtle, but give me, like, maybe two more of those type spots where the referee just seems like he's almost favoring Luger and just going too hard on Ricky Steamboat. Like, I could see, turf him, toss his ass out of the ring, fuck this, go to town. But they just, I don't know, like, they didn't quite get there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not bad, obviously. I mean, it's really good, but just, I don't know. Just felt like I'm missing something.
All right, and I know people really love this match. And I kind of get it,
I'm one of them.
Yeah.
I love it now. But I do acknowledge there are issues with it in terms of the finish and things like that. I was like, man, if they had just booked Lex better, they really had something with him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But very immersive, very, very watchable on a show that, again, is one of the best. But you know, I'm a little lower on it than I think many. Jenny, you're lower on it than me, it sounds like.
Probably.
But that's how we do it on Talking WCW.
Sure is.
So, okay. I think that I am next, right?
Yes.
And it's just from our next year of Great American Bashes. This one was from July 7th, 1990. We're still in Baltimore, still in the Baltimore Arena. And I chose what's probably our most under the radar of all of our choices here tonight. But I think that's really in the spirit of this podcast. I love picking matches like this that I would consider hidden gems, but that, you know, don't even get called out for being hidden gems. Like, they just never get talked about, I feel like. But this is, I'm just going to say it, I absolutely love this match. It's Tracy Smothers and Steve Armstrong, the wild-eyed Southern boys.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Versus the Midnight Express. This is for the United States Tag Team Championship. So another title match. Let's just say it. The Southern boys are dressed like Confederate generals.
They are.
Stars and stripes across their asses. We'll just have to ignore that. It is what it is.
can I point out something about the Southern boys? There's a lot to unpack here about the Southern boys, but uncomfortable. The attire is uncomfortable, the gimmick is uncomfortable, but I will throw to my good friend Nick Duke, my fellow hard traveling fanboy, when I was discussing this match with him earlier today. And he said to me, he started laughing and he said, how is somebody being called the Southern boys going to distinguish them in 1990 WCW? And I said, he said, aren't they all Southern boys?
But they're not wild-eyed.
Yeah, that's the difference. That's the key. Because at first, JR calls them Southern Boys, and then Bob Caudle corrects him and says, the wild-eyed Southern Boys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, what exactly, Tim, is a wild-eyed Southern Boy?
Well, a wild-eyed Southern Boy, I gather, is a Tracy Smothers and a Steve Armstrong. Don't they actually get repackaged as the Young Pistols?
The Young Pistols, a much better name. Not a great name.
I like that name.
But yeah, a much better name.
Much better name. And what's a Southern Boy? Well, it's a Young Pistol. What's a Young Pistol? It's a Southern Boy.
Well, the wild eyes is what really, how you can really tell.
I'll tell you what it is. The wild eyes is, this is a comparison I've used for this tag team more than once, but it's basically like if your friend's new stepdad who works at the Lorillard tobacco plant and his coworker decided to become a pro wrestling tag team, but they were like inexplicably really good at it. That's what the wild eyes.
You get the impression, or at least I do, that Tracy and Steve, just like every other men, are going, whoo, yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Tell you what, boy.
Exactly.
Like Yosemite Sam.
Yep.
Maybe they're like crashing beers backstage after their matches.
Want to talk about the stars and bars?
Uh-huh. slapping hands. I mean.
I just love, like, and the thing is, like, I was a kid in the South at that time, so yeah, that was everywhere. It wasn't like this was a rare occasion. It's just, in hindsight, boy, oh boy, between that and the Freebirds,
well, I mean,
problematic times.
This is going to say, well, speaking of problematic, this is going to sound terrible, but I mean, I don't know how to say this. It almost wasn't even, like, a political statement back, like, it wasn't the very overt political statement that it is now of where people only do it at only, you know, brandish that kind of imagery as a way of saying, come at me, basically.
Yeah. It, at that time, it wasn't another way of saying I'm a shithead.
Right. Right.
I mean, it's shitty.
I mean, it was.
But it, I mean, was. It was. It was.
An unintentional way of saying I'm a shithead.
Yeah,
but
it wasn't a... like throwing a spot.
It was, yes, it was genuinely from a place of ignorance rather than from a place of spite as it is nowadays.
Mm-hmm. So, all right. This is a lot, this match. It is. Wow. So we get a brawl erupting before the bell. Midnight's ambushing the Southern Boys, but the boys clear the ring with a double team backdrop, then a shoulder block. Now, as the match properly gets started, we're going to pair off with Armstrong and Eaton. Jim Cornette at ringside is imploring a fan to, quote, wipe the ugly off your face, you stinking pig-faced moron.
Holy shit.
Establishing who our heels are, despite
the crowd.
Out in the strong southern leanings of
I was gonna say, like, in the for beginning of this match, that crowd is way more into the Midnights than they are into the Southern Boys. And credit to everybody involved that they get them. And also, before we get too far into the match, I wanted to throw attention. Mm-hmm. Bobby Eaton's mullet is sensational.
Yeah, yes. Resplendent.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And this is, you know, we're now getting into 1990s Midnights, so you would think they're past their heyday, but can they still go? Let's see here. You get Eaton starting things off, body slam. Scott goes up top, but he gets tossed and caught in a catapult, and then a drop kick by Scott Armstrong. Armstrong with a clothesline off the top rope. Bobby regroups on the outside. Smothers then tagging in. Double team arm drag has Bobby now begging off. Here's a great sequence with the savate kick, which causes Bobby Eaton to retreat into his corner. Finally.
JR's favorite, man. That was JR's favorite move to call at that time. The savate kick. Along with the judo chop.
Yeah. Well, it actually took a pair of those savate kicks for Bobby to tag out to his partner. Because, this is very important, Stan Lane, you see, is a martial arts specialist.
Mm-hmm. A black belt, even, they say on commentary.
Yeah, if we're getting to the Savant portion of the evening, you better get Stan Lane in there. We have a bit of a karate pose down. I don't know what else to call it.
This was awesome.
It was really great. Is, you know, for now we're doing Karate Kid Part 4, I guess. Stan Lane with a series of, I don't know what to call them, but karate strikes and smothers.
That was so Tony Schiavone of you.
Thank you. Smothers counters with a backhand and then a thrust kick, not to be confused with a savate kick, but a thrust.
Totally different moves. Completely different.
Midnights are just taking a beating here, but they continue to really just dictate the pace, even on offense and on defense, excuse me, which I think was just very smart and speaks to their competency as a you know, classic, well-rounded tag team. They're kind of keeping it slow. They don't, even though they're getting their asses kicked, they don't want the Southern boys to gain any momentum, basically. So Eaton tags back in, but he walks right into an arm drag. But Lane comes in from behind, attacks Smothers, while Bobby is taking the powder on the outside. Things break down from here. As Eaton comes back in, we get the double team now on the Southern boys by the Midnights. But Armstrong comes off the top with a crossbody to wipe out both Midnights. And now the match here just kind of resets. We get this sequence where it looks like the Midnights are going to take over, but they just can't gain the advantage here. Now Smothers rolls up Eaton, but he misses the blind tag by the Midnights and gets sent into the ring barricade by Stan Lane. And here is where the Midnights, just true to form, vintage Midnight Express now. Cornette jabbing Tracy Smothers with that tennis racket on the outside while referee Mike Atkins is distracted. Back in the ring, you've got Stan Lane quickly tagging in Bobby Eaton. Hits an atomic drop into a backbreaker, signature move from the Midnights there. Midnights are just utilizing quick tags, and that allows them to double team their opponents, and they assert control here. Alabama Jam by beautiful Bobby Eaton on the button, but he cannot capitalize, seems to hurt himself as well. So he has to tag out to Lane. We get a desperation sunset flip by Tracy Smothers, who's really on the receiving end of this heat segment by the Midnights. Lane kicks out of that, tags Eaton back in there, who comes in with an awesome swinging neck breaker, going back to Stan Lane now with a butterfly suplex, and now we get more of those quick tags. It's almost hard to keep up with because there is no discontinuity to the offense by the Midnight Express. You don't even really see the tags while all these, you know, moves are happening, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And yet they're happening. Like, they're doing all of this within the structure and the framework of the match, rules. Which is within the rules of the match.
It's just so incredibly smooth. So Tracy Smothers finally gets the hot tag. Armstrong comes in, clears house. The Southern boys using a combination missile drop kick into spine buster on Stan Lane, looks to put it away, but the referee is out of position. So then Bobby Eaton shoves Scott Armstrong off the top rope. The Midnights then hit their rocket launcher. That's their move. That should do it. But just a near fall, inside cradle by Smothers. This should do it, right? Nope. Stan Lane in there to break it up. Fans are going berserk at this point. All of these near falls. But then Stan Lane on the outside kicks Tracy Smothers in the back of the head while he's coming off the ropes, sending him right into a Bobby Eaton roll up for the win. Again, smooth as silk. Man, this is an awesome tag team match. It is a title match, but it's the United States Tag Team Championship. So it feels a little low stakes. It can feel a little even exhibition-y. I don't know how much of a backstory there really was to this, but I also don't really care because it's a match that works so well in isolation, can be enjoyed in a vacuum on what is kind of a weird pay-per-view with a lot of just sort of random matches. This one stands out to me as a true highlight. I absolutely love it. And I don't know what more to say other than go out of your way to see it if you haven't. I think it stands up against any really fast-paced, modern-day tag team match you might watch today from if you're like an NXT fan, for example. That's sort of what it reminds me of.
Yeah, I was reminded of, you know, not any NXT that you and I have watched recently when it comes to tag teams, but
well, no.
Really good tag teams. That fluidity and that familiarity.
The revival era.
Yes.
Yeah.
With each other. Yeah. And, but also it is very chaotic. Like it's smooth and there, like it's so well done, but it's also sort of feels messy at the same time. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's a smooth, messy match.
Well, yeah. It's wild. Well, you can tell it's very, it has to be very choreographed in order for this to come off well, but it doesn't feel like it's rehearsed at the same time. If that
right. It doesn't, I'll go ahead and say what I was thinking as you were talking about there. It does not resemble a Young Bucks match.
No,
there's like still enough stank on everything that it feels a little bit like it just feels more natural.
It does. And the crowd is so freaking into it. I feel like it just hypes everybody up in the ring. Like everybody's on their shit. Like everybody's where they need to be. I don't know the Southern Boys. Like, are they in another match ever? Like, I've like never heard of these people ever.
I mean, I don't know much about them.
Yeah, they teamed up for about 2 years in WCW, and it was about, they were the Southern Boys for about a year, I think, and then they became the Young Pistols for a while, and then they turned heel, and they were the heel Young Pistols for a little while, and then they broke up. But yeah, they were around for quite some time, but they don't have a lot of, I mean, this is their crowning moment, this quite honestly. They never have another moment like this.
What happens?
Just WCW at the time wasn't strong, and they got kind of swallowed up by the fact that they were in the same company as the Steiner brothers, essentially. So there wasn't any room as the top babyface team outside of the Steiners, because, you know, I mean, let's be honest, it's the Southern Boys versus the Steiners.
Right.
So then, and then on the heel side, you would have teams like the Dangerous Alliance that came along, and then, you know, but by the time, so by the time 92 rolls around, the Young Pistols are kind of odd men out. And also, they have also been affected by the fact that they didn't really have characters or a gimmick, per se. Mm-hmm. They were just good old boys. And in a company filled with good old boys, there wasn't much that made them stand out other than the fact they were good wrestlers.
Yeah, they were like a good wrestling version of, I mean, the Freebirds at this point, honestly, right?
Right. Yeah.
I feel like the world doesn't deserve Bobby Eaton.
I agree. Yes.
He is amazing.
So sorry.
Some of his facial expressions remind me at times of John C. Reilly, and I can't explain why.
Oh, I feel you on that.
I can see it, yes.
But from the mullet, I mean, everything he does in the fucking ring is awesome to watch. He steals the show. Like, on this match, and like I said, they're all on point. But he's in it most of the time, unless we need some karate.
Oh man!
I mean, I was not prepared for the karate.
We did need some karate, though, didn't we?
I would have never thought it did, but it did.
It did.
It was so awesome.
It completely worked, which I just think goes to the magic of this match, and this is like top tier, like tag wrestling. This is the shit I like to watch. I love this match too, Tim.
Thank you. I'm glad to have some validation.
Whenever people say that we've progressed as a society, I think back to the fact that nowadays this segment would have to be a worked MMA thing if they were going to do it, and it wouldn't look half as good. But you go back then, go back 30 years, and we were having damn karate matches in the middle of the wrestling match because karate was in at the time.
It's amazing. And Cornette on the outside just stirring up trouble as he does. Yeah. He gets in on that final kick. They timed it where I don't know if Corny just like came in just to do it as the kick came in towards the end.
The timing on the rep distractions.
Yeah, I mean,
unbelievably
it's
good.
Crazy.
I don't know how. I really don't know how they you know, especially in a time when they didn't really necessarily go move for move in advance, how you get that timing so down is incredible to me. But yeah, mm-hmm. a great match all around. Everybody was awesome. I thought, you know, I see Bobby Eaton wrestle all the time because of this show. We watch a lot of great matches with him in it. But I hadn't seen Stan wrestle in a long time, and he was really good too. He's they're just great as a team, and and Smothers and Armstrong were a hell of a team together. I feel like if they had had, maybe if they'd come on at a different time, or maybe if they had a different mouthpiece for them to help get them over, because neither one was a very strong promo at that time. It may have worked better long term, but they were a hell of a team, and this is a really great tag match.
And this is, by the way, I guess we have to have this conversation because it's a Midnight Express match. My preferred version of the Midnights. I love Stan Lane. I think that any match, really any match, is going to benefit from a karate segment.
any Stan match, Lane, yes.
Yeah, any well, match.
A good
Stan
challenge.
Lane allows you to do that.
Yes, a good challenge for our listeners is think of a great match in history that wouldn't have been made even better with by a karate like imagine Hogan and Andre the Giant at WrestleMania 3 if suddenly Andre had held his arm up like Stan Lane did here and challenged mm-hmm. the Hulkster to do a karate battle.
Yeah.
Oh, the blacktop bully, you know, in the back of the...
Are you kidding me? A karate sequence in the back of an 18-wheeler that's moving down the road?
I mean, that's been... the only thing that could make it any better.
Dustin Rhodes throwing Savat kicks.
Yeah. I've never heard that term ever.
Savat kick.
Savat kick. Savat is an actual martial art that is
it's a French form of kickboxing.
Yes,
it?
Yes. And how I know this is because of the game Street Fighter. Because there was a character, and I'm trying to remember which one it was, that was known for his savate skills, according to the instruction manual at the time. But nonetheless, it's a kick based style. There was a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie.
Was it
where,
Vega? I think it was
Vega. I think
the guy with the Wolverine claw.
Yes. there's a couple of Van Damme movies, The Quest and Bloodsport, in which I believe he fights a savate fighter at one point in there, where it's a French guy that literally just kicks all the time. But anyway, all that to be said, it is a form of martial arts. However, nothing we saw in this match resembled savate at all.
So he's just totally pulling that out of his ass, right?
Pretty much. Saying? I mean, it is kicks. So, I mean, if you're going to go with a kick-based martial art, then I guess that's fine.
I mean, he could call it a karate kick. He could call it a kung fu kick, I suppose.
Yeah, oh my
but,
God, please
but
no.
Savat,
taekwondo kick.
A taekwondo kick, but savat makes it sound more sophisticated.
Yes, more sophisticated, because only a Frenchman would use savat typically.
Well, you know, another great savat martial artist practitioner, Batroc the Leaper, played by Georges Saint-Pierre.
Yes,
the Captain America film.
An absolutely amazing character, and yes, he is a master of savate, because when you're from whatever country you're from, you are predetermined to use that country's preferred martial art.
Always.
So if you're from France, it's going to be savate. If you're from Brazil, it's going to be Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Mm-hmm. Japan, judo. America, some form of brawling.
Yeah.
I will say that Smothers was pretty great in this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, because Armstrong got to hang out for a long time. Yeah. Like, Smothers got his ass
whooped.
Yeah,
got the lion's share.
Yeah. And it was funny because Bobby, like the whole first part of the match, like, he wouldn't tag in. He'd go over there and talk to Stan, or he'd go there and talk to Corny, but he wouldn't tag. I'm like, is he going to tag? And then I realized once they got to the karate, I was like, oh, they were just waiting for that karate part.
Waiting for some karate.
Oh, my God. So great.
You know what else is refreshing about Bobby Eaton? He didn't give a damn about a tan.
Nope. Mm-mm.
He just went out there as pale and pasty as he could be, and nobody cared.
He's
great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
The only thing missing from this match was like a random Bobby Eaton diamond cutter, like he did in that one like a Halloween Havoc match or whatever, which I think it was just a botched neck breaker, but he still kind of pulled it off because he's Bobby Eaton. So if he just busted out a diamond cutter on one of these dudes, I mean, I'd give it like 6 stars.
Yeah.
So as it stands, it's like a mere, it's like a mere five star. You know, it's,
and
it's
such a. And I will say, like, seeing, you know, alluding to it earlier, seeing how much chaotic fun you can still have within the basic structure of a tag mm-hmm. team match mm-hmm. makes me appreciate what tag team wrestling can be.
Yes.
At its best, because it's always been my favorite. I don't know if I even said this on the show. I've always preferred tag team wrestling to singles wrestling. I think when it's mm-hmm. done right, it's the most fun, the most interesting, the best form of wrestling. But I think that nowadays a lot of teams cheat, so to speak, to get their great matches in and everything. And it doesn't feel as organic. It doesn't feel as special as what we got in with teams like this that worked really, really smart and still managed to have these chaotic, fun brawls that worked you into the story of the match rather than what cool move is going to be next.
Agreed. Yeah, and well said.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, before we get to our last match, I will tell you guys real quick about what we got going on right here on the Place to Be Wrestling Network. You can find the new episode of Pro Wrestling Love. That is episode number 36. WWF 1978 through 1987, part one, with Marty Sleaze and the true titan of wrestling, Kelly Nielsen. They go through the picks for number 25 through 21 on the first of a five-part series and the best matches between 78 and 87. So check that one out. The new NWA Day After Saturday special is Scott and Dr. G. Talking about Thunder Rosa's signing with AEW and what it means for them and the NWA. On the new Special Relations, that is a throwback. The night it was live, pal. That is Sunday, March 29th, 2020, with a special live edition with Callum and Ben and Rory. So God knows what they came up with live. So listen to that one. And then a
Calling on the fly, brother.
Right. Making Mount Rushmore with Chad Campbell, John Kesaleka, and Ben Locke with Andy Atherton to discuss which setup moves deserve a spot on their Mount Rushmores. So check that one out as well. Always, we have a new Place to Be podcast coming up soon, and you can check out placetobenation.com on the website for all kinds of articles on sports and pop culture. Everything that we're doing is linked on the website, and you can follow us on all the social media platforms. And so you can check out the PTB Wrestling Network store on tpublic.com and type in PTBW in the search, and you can buy merch and support us that way. All right, so my pick is going to bring us home, and I took a lot of recommendations for this, and I got a lot. Like, apparently, you know, there's some great matches in Great American Bash, and I debated a couple, but what I settled on was Sting versus Vader from 1992, and I mean, the reason is Vader. I freaking love Vader. It's going to be hard pressed for me not to pick a Vader match.
Yeah.
If I had the choice. So,
you chose there, well.
I know. Is there anything that y'all want to fill me in on before I start the recap?
So Vader and Sting had met once or twice, at least once before this. And the one in particular that is being referenced by the commentary in this, they met a couple months prior, several months prior, on an episode of one of the weekend TV shows, and Vader broke Sting's ribs at that time, crushed his ribs and left him vulnerable. And finally, months down the line, this is the rematch from that, where we're going to find out if Sting, the champion, can rise to the occasion against his biggest and most dangerous challenger to date, the man they call Vader.
So, were y'all hyped for this match?
Yeah. I was. Are you talking about now or back then?
Well, back both, I guess.
Well, back then, yes. I was an 8-year-old. I was a little stinger. And many people that are longtime listeners of this show may remember my story about this match, that I was a little diehard little stinger at the time. And when I didn't see this match live, but the weekend recap shows, like where they would talk about, you know, they'd show still footage from the match and show kind of what happened. Sometimes it even shows sequences in WCW. And I remember that next weekend, I was so excited to see if Sting, how Sting retained his title. I had no doubt he was going to win, because that was what I was conditioned to think. The good guy always wins in the end. In theory, I don't know why I thought that was Sting, because he often didn't. But nonetheless, I ended up crying. I remember little 8-year-old Greg crying because Sting had failed. Not only failed, but the recap honestly made it look like more of a beating than it actually was. The recap they did on the weekend shows made it sound like Vader just beat him clean, like you know, beat him up and beat him clean. And Sting had nothing for him, and I was so disappointed and disheartened and sad that Sting got beat up, and I knew he hit his head on the pole or whatever, and I was like, oh, that's not good. But nonetheless, I've subsequently seen this match several times, of course, and it's one of my all-time favorite matches. It is the I equate this to the Nightfall in the Sting Vader saga.
Oh, okay.
And so this is the breaking of the bat, And it sets up a nice redemption story for Sting that culminates later in the year, and then unculminates in January of the next year.
I was going to say, I think you've also likened this to the death of Superman.
Yes, yes.
Vader as the Doomsday.
As Doomsday, yes. Absolutely. Superman. Absolutely.
I didn't see this at the time, certainly, but when I got back into wrestling, I remember hearing about the just trilogy of legendary pay-per-view matches that Sting and Vader had from this time period, 92 to 93. And I would be remiss in not pointing out in my duties as a broadcast journalist that we have covered those other two matches on this podcast.
Yes,
we talked the sequel to this match, that being Halloween Havoc 1992. That was on our Sting episode. And we did the follow-up to that, the rubber match, the White Castle of Fear strap match from Super Brawl 3.
Did I pick both of those?
I know you picked the White Castle of Fear.
I picked the Starrcade one, because it's my favorite of their matches.
Yeah, so on our Vader episode, Jenny, you picked the strap match.
Right.
But this is what kicked us off, at least their pay-per-view run. Of course, they do have one more singles match on pay-per-view. That was
Slamboree
94, and they have that cool triangle match with the Boss or the Guardian Angel.
The Guardian Angel, yes. At
that point. Whatever they're calling him, which I really like that too. But anyway, Jenny, this is your pick, and we now officially are covering the great Sting Vader trilogy in its entirety. So,
awesome. Yeah. Well, I'm glad to close this out. So Vader comes out with his amazing headpiece. What are we calling it? Does it have a name?
Mastodon.
The Mastodon, that's it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that thing is amazing. Always pop for the entrance. Sting also looking very extra in his red, white, and blue.
Oh, yeah. Well, I always loved it when he had the red, white, and blue.
Yeah, that.
And Harley Race managing Vader with his perm.
Yes.
Oh, man, yeah. Harley Race with the perm, of course, is looking as Thurman Merman as ever.
So they like to, you know, start out jawjacking a lot. You know, they were in each other's face quite a bit in the beginning. And Vader, of course, gets him into the corner, punching him just as soon as he possibly can. He no-sells the clothesline. Sting dunks out of the corner a little bit, get after a whip, and gets a little bit of offense, gets a clothesline that knocks Vader to the floor for a minute. Huge pop for that. That's pretty early in the match to be knocking Vader from the ring, so Harley did not like that at all. Vader gets back in and wants to do test of strength. Like, okay, big boy, let's try this. Sting very hesitant to try that, as he should be, but after a minute, decides he's going to go for it. He gets his wrist, like, basically almost broken real quick by Vader. But then he thumbs him in the eye and drop kicks him. So, clever to get away from him in that way. He does a suplex over the rope while Vader's standing on the apron. That was impressive. Vader really jumped up for him, but it looked real good. Sting tries... No, he hits Sting in the ribs. He does like a... I don't even know. Kind of just takes his fist and goes... Boom! Right in his wrist on both sides.
A savate punch.
Yeah, savate punch.
Yes.
That's what that is. Knocks the breath out of him. Puts him on the floor. But he jumps up and gets another drop kick. He tries for a flip, but Vader sits down right on his freaking chest to knock the wind out of him once again. It's just like everything that Sting tries, Vader just, you know, just matches him by just brutalizing him. It's so rough looking, which is amazing. Vader just soaking up all the fucking hate, like, from the crowd. Like, they are just, I mean, he just revels in it, and only the way that he can. He just loves it, right? It fuels him, and it's amazing to watch. He picks up Sting by the throat, throws him back down again, gets him in the Scorpion Deathlock. All right, so... That one lasts a minute. Like, he gets in it. Like, he locks it in, and he sits on it, and I need to
break in here to as you guys know, I'm legally obligated to rate every sharpshooter.
In sharpshooter adjacent.
That's applied. And I have to give Vader a very low score on this one.
Low score? Come on.
He's almost to the Rock level of sloppy sharpshooters.
A man of his size,
I've never seen a man of that size do the Scorpion Deathlock. So
to me, that was the impressive part of it.
That's fair.
But Sting breaks out of that. Going back to big punches and whips and big clotheslines. Just stomping him. Sting looking cooked. Does a big power slam for two. Sting though, he wants to power back a little bit. It bounces off the ropes in what was called a rolling karate kick by, I think Jim Ross calls it that. That's something like that. He kind of bounced off the ropes and then, I don't know, kicked him and knocked him down and then hits the DDT. Tries to knock him out, tries to knock Vader out, but he only gets him on the apron. So Vader climbs up. Not to the third rope, but up to the second rope in the corner. And then Sting kind of knocks him down, and he's kind of splayed across the top with, like, his belly on the turnbuckle, basically. And Sting takes advantage, starts kicking him in the stomach, and then puts him up on his shoulders. And he holds him up there for a good minute. That was something else. And then slams him for two. Tries to suplex again, but it gets blocked. Then Vader picks up Sting. I'm not sure what they were going for, but Sting's leg kind of clips the ref and knocks him down. Then Sting gets a suplex, a nice suplex, and the bridge for a visual pin, but sorry, the ref wasn't watching. Then he tries the Stinger Splash in both of the corners. But on that second corner, Vader has his back to him for the splash and is kind of bending over. He comes in and then just rams his head on the pole, bleeding everywhere, just draped over the whole fucking deal, like in the corner looking dead as shit.
He hit the pole.
Yeah, he hit the pole. That's what happened. Vader, he's dazed and he's bleeding, but Vader goes for the cover, only gets two, and then commentary just totally putting over the head injury, and that's what's happened. And then he says, "Well, fuck this!" Big power bomb for the win for Vader. Fucking awesome, a war like brutal and rough, and just what I want to see in a damn Vader match.
Yeah.
And Sting just laid out in the middle of the ring as Vader wins and walks away with his belt. So. Awesome shit. I fucking love this match.
It's amazing. Not the first time that they've touched, not the first time they've had a match, but their first major match they've had. One of the best first major matches between two guys I've ever seen. Like, they instantly have chemistry. from the get-go. The match just kicks ass from beginning to end. Vader comes off as the biggest badass in the world. Sting comes off as the biggest babyface in the world. Mm-hmm. Never say die. Superhuman strength at times. You talked about that big Samoan drop that he gives him where he holds him up there for mm-hmm. what feels like an eternity. Sting still has that explosive leap with the kicks and the, you know, stinger splashes that where I actually bought the fact that he jumped so high that he actually went too far and cleared Vader and hit his head on the pole.
Yeah.
He hit the pole. Tim, give me a little bit of Mahler real quick.
Oh, he hit the pole.
Okay. Anyway, so this is all, the match is just amazing.
Like, I was not ready for that.
So, Sting, I have heard, over the course of time, I have heard so much slander on Sting's name in the course of 25 or so years on the internet from people like Scott Keith and et cetera. And I'm here to say, y'all can all kiss my fat, pasty, white ass because it's awesome. Sting has always been awesome. I knew he was awesome because I watched it at the time when I was a kid, and he's awesome in these matches that we watch every month here on Talking WCW. And Vader is awesome as the unstoppable heel. Harley is awesome at ringside, complaining about I always thought that Harley didn't add much to Vader's presentation, but he's really good here. Complaining because Sting clotheslines Vader over the top rope, which he's arguing should be grounds for disqualification, which. I don't know why you'd want that, of course, because the title right. wouldn't change hands. But nonetheless, the other thing about this, the commentary was fantastic in this match, in my opinion. This is, of course, JR and Jesse the Body, and we're getting closer to what I consider peak JR because he feels so much more emotional in this match, whereas in 89 and 90, he's kind of just calling the moves and kind of, you know, telling the story. Here, he's into the story of the match, and he's actively rooting for Sting to win this match. And you can hear the passion in his voice as he's calling these moves and calling Sting's comeback. And what do you think about the champion? What heart by the champion? You know, this is getting closer to like what we know as prime JR. And Jesse the Body's great here, too. Harley ain't done nothing. And then JR goes, well, I didn't say he did nothing. I said he needs to be in his corner. That's where he needs to be. And I give him old man JR voice. But nonetheless, Jesse is great here, calling the match like a sporting event, but clearly having a slight preference for Vader, not going over the top with it, talking about the heart of the champion and all that. And just great athleticism, great match all in all, from beginning to end. Sets the course for what's to come. We know that Sting may have had Vader pinned at one point with a back suplex. The referee was out of position. And so we know that Sting might be able to get him, but we don't know how moving forward. And that would set up, of course, Sting's quest the rest of the year, leading into Starrcade, and then, of course, culminating in the White Castle of Fear. So great pick, Jenny. My favorite match of the three. All three were great matches. This one is, of course, just a little cut above for me. Emotional connection and all. So you can't say enough about both guys' performances in this match. And it really does stand out to me. You know, we've done this show this time around, and we've seen Lex Luger have a great match. We've seen, of course, a great tag team match. We've seen Vader have another great match, and we've seen Sting have a great match. And it feels like a trend to me. And so I feel like there's a lot of narratives that are unfair about WCW, which I think was part of what we were trying to do here with this show, is kind of present the other side of WCW that doesn't get talked about enough, which is the good side. Right. And for all the talk about how WCW never built stars, they built Lex Luger, they built Sting, they built Vader, and they had them. They weren't utilized properly. I will not defend that, but there's no doubt that WCW had the talent there at the time to be number one. They didn't handle it properly, but these guys are all fantastic that we watched this week.
Absolutely. And I would just add to that every time I watch this match, I think I like it a little bit more. I see something, I notice something I didn't previously. And I don't know, it doesn't seem like the type of match that would lend itself to that kind of viewing, but it really is that for me, in a way that their other matches, their follow-ups to this, just kind of have always stood on their own as being as great as they've always been. This one I always find a little bit more to love. And I know that people, some people have really likened it to, you know, that John Cena, Brock Lesnar, SummerSlam match in terms of just a really dominant heel victory. It's certainly not as one-sided as that.
Right.
That match is a glorified squash, and this I would never describe as a squash, but I can see why people draw that comparison, because it is as dominant and decisive of a heel victory, a clean heel victory, as you would have gotten in like a 1992 major promotion. It's just the type of thing that generally wasn't done at the time. And having said that, Sting does still have some cover here, just in the sense that, okay, he went into it with a rib injury. He hit his head on the post at one point, rung his bell, potentially had a visual pin on Vader with that suplex, that bridge. So, but at the same time, it's like, there's no reason to think Vader couldn't have won it in spite of, you know,
right.
Sting being,
you can always use the excuse that Vader is preserving his energy to kick out until he hears the referee's hand. So.
Right. It's not like any of these things diminish Vader in any way. It's just, it's giving you good cause to have the rematch that they do. Granted, I don't know if a King of Cable tournament is the best route to get there, but be that as it may, they got there.
Imagine my confusion as a young kid when they announced the, I don't know what cable is at this point in my life. So when they announced a King of Cable tournament, I'm thinking, first of all, about the X-Men character Cable, X-Force, Rob Liefeld's Cable. And then I'm thinking about actual lines of cable.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, why would anyone want to be the king of that?
A king of a cable?
Yeah.
I was like, are they going to be presented with a ceremonial cord of some sort that represents the cable that they are the king of now? Like,
they're getting a ceremonial metal arm and yellow eye.
Yeah,
there you go. And a gun that's larger than they are. It's getting very esoteric, you know, at that point in WCW. But all that is to say, this is a match that stands on its own as being really great, but, you know, in nice little subtle ways sets these things up for the future. And I love that it's a perfect pathway to that Starrcade sequel, where both men come in at 100% to see truly who is the man, with no excuses, no dodge. You have to just go into it completely healthy. And these two would have some wars, but awesome match, awesome finish, awesome showcase for the van they call Vader.
Oh, did you guys notice the lines on commentary when Vader knocks Sting down at one point and he starts posing, and Ventura goes, "Look at him there, he's posing down. He's got the most muscular. He's not the most ripped guy in the world, but he's very powerful." And then JR cuts in and goes, "Well, I hear bodybuilding's not doing too good these days. There's not much of a future in it." And Ventura goes, "Yeah, there's no money in it, I can tell you that." Which, of course, were both shots at the World Bodybuilding Federation that Vince had just launched.
There you go. Shots fired.
I will say, like, as much as I love watching Vader just, like, be brutal and, like, beat people, just because it looks real to me, I like watching him work in his, like, in the way he makes them look good, right? Like, I can see the effort he puts forth in, like, a suplex or whatever, you know what I'm saying? Like, I can see him, the way that he uses his body to help his opponent look good, right? And I don't know, normally I don't want to see that, and I don't like to see that, but there's something about when Vader does it that I like it. I don't know, it's strange.
You wouldn't think of a man Vader's.
It's showing you the effort that he puts in.
And he's, it's like he just hangs with everybody. Like, he stays in and he works with what they do well. And and he gives everything to them, as brutal as he is with his own shit, right? So it just looks amazing. And then I just watched Sting go into the corner again, and his head was nowhere near the post. And I just, like, literally watched him bleed, and I'm sorry, I when I can spot it, I pop for that too. You're probably not supposed to, but I always do, especially when I watch it back.
Well, they're also showing it on slow motion here at
they
the
do.
End.
They
slow
do.
Motion with the most zoomed in camera possible. Right out of the corner. I can see Bill Watts backstage blowing a gasket.
I don't know why. I mean, like, that's the stuff that probably drives most people crazy, but it's the charming stuff for me.
I mean, it worked for me because I never thought about it. I mean, when you're an 8-year-old, you don't think about, you know, what, well, did he hit his head in exactly the spot where he was bleeding? You don't think about that. You just see blood and you see his head there, and you think, oh, no, his selling was so good. Like, he really sold it like he had a concussion. And
he did.
And also, after the match, did you guys see Nikita Koloff come out to help Sting wearing his flip-flops with his...
I could have for Sting.
His singlet and flip-flops.
Oh, my God. For Nikita.
Straight from the showers.
That's such a bad look.
Nikita just did not fit in at all in 1992 WCW, honestly, but nonetheless, he had some good matches, but, you know, whatever. Anyway, yeah, tremendous show all around here this week. I think three great matches of different style, totally different styles. All three of these matches completely different from one another.
All early Great American Bash matches too. We didn't even get very deep into the 90s here.
Yeah, we might have to have a part two.
There's potential.
Next summer.
Mm. I like it.
Whose turn? I think it's Greg's turn.
I think it's my turn. And I have been silently debating this pick because I have two choices I'm waffling between. One that I had planned going in and another that popped up as a result of this very show.
Mm. Mm.
I'm going back and forth, because one of them I feel we need to do at some point. We haven't yet. And that was the one I had planned going in. But you reminded me this week how much I love tag team wrestling. I'm going to flip a coin if I can find a coin, which is, you know, always.
Go to justflipacoin.com.
I found a real. I found a real coin. I found a dime.
An analog coin.
Yes. Or actually, a penny might even be better because it's bigger. All right. Let's see. All right. Heads is going to be my original choice. Tails will be my new choice.
Okay.
We'll see which one is it here. It is heads. So it's going to go with the original choice, which is Stunning Steve Austin.
Yeah! Oh, great choice. Okay.
Did not see that coming. Okay.
I like it.
I feel like it's one that we need to do at some point. We haven't done yet, and there's a lot of content to choose from, more than many listeners may realize if they're more modern fans. So yes, I'm excited to delve into his WCW career. By the way, my other option I was considering was the Midnight Express. So I'm going with. With Stunning Steve here as we get to delve into a little bit of early to mid-90s WCW action.
Yeah, I don't know that we've had much of his work on here outside of
War Games.
War Games that he was in.
Oh, that'll be good. I'm excited for that.
So we've got a lot of options. A whole lot of options.
All right. Well, if we're all done, Greg, is there anything that you want to promote before we're out of here?
Not really. People can follow me on Twitter, gphillips8652. You'll find my opinions on some things, and including wrestling. I watch wrestling pretty regularly, and so that's good. Anybody wants to follow me, I'll follow them back. And other than that, not really anything going on right now. If you're a PlayStation user and you would like to play me in a rousing game of Marvel's Avengers, I am Hitman Clark on PlayStation 5. So that's all we got.
What about you, Tim?
Jenny, we do another wrestling podcast here on Place to Be Nation Wrestling. It's called PTB NXT. It's you, me, and Jacob Williams going through weekly NXT television as well as takeovers. We are in the year 2014, in the fall of 2014 with some TV leading into, I guess, the third takeover event. God willing, we'll get there. So we had a recent installment of that show that you can find in the archives here.
Is this the build of the Sami Zayn and Adrian Neville match?
It just started. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's so one of the best matches in NXT history.
Yep. Yep. So we got through TakeOver Fatal 4-Way, which, I mean, Sammy was involved in. Neville's the champion. But now it feels like we're doing, like, the hard build to the singles match that we haven't really seen yet. So exciting times ahead in NXT. I am also a part of Pop Goes to the Couch on our sister network, Place Be Nation Pop Experience, where I talk the Marvel MCU television shows on Disney Plus primarily. So we're on a break now. We just wrapped up Loki. When those come back, so will I, but the show will continue in many other forms. Of course, we have movie reviews on Place Be Nation Pop as well. Jenny, you and I got together with Andy Atherton to talk about Black Widow. So staying contemporary with MCU releases, first feature film in a long time. Spoiler, we kind of liked it.
Yep.
So look for that. Also, one of our sister networks, the North-South Connection, I have started a new show with JT Rosero. We also have a rotating guest to do a new television venture. That is 90210 NOSO. Just going through the series. Beverly Hills 90210, the OG classic. So we just started that. We've done the pilot. We've done the second through third, fourth episode, depending on how you're watching it and how the pilot is split. And we've had a different guest for each episode of that podcast. Jenny, you are one of them. Greg, we would love to get you in. So basically, people, if they're interested, can go out, pick an episode that they'd like to do. It could be, I mean, we're in the first season. We're going to be there for a while. But if you want to do an episode from that first season, anywhere into the 10th season, put your name in and we'll put you down for it. If you have a particular favorite or favorites. So yeah, that show has been a lot of fun to do. We basically do a lot of categories, a lot of character rankings type stuff. You know, take a retrospective view on things. Most 90s.
What network has the 90210 show now?
Okay, so you can watch it streaming on Hulu or on CBS All Access, I believe. Now, the somewhat of an issue with that is they do have gaps in their season. They'll have episodes inexplicably missing for some reason. Just random episodes here and there will not be listed. If that is the case, I'm not really hard publicizing this, but just hit me up. We do have ways and means around that. You know, I'm not putting a lot of stuff out there that can be taken down, but privately, if someone were to message me asking, hey, do you have a way of watching such and such episode? I may have an answer for them. I'll just put it that way. So yeah, lots of ways to watch the show. In other words, watch Tim, along with us.
Tim got so many dark web applications to get his fucking.
I have resources.
I did think of one thing to potentially shill. It's not even officially, but to shill. But as many people may know, not many people, as very few people know, Nick and I every year, my old hard traveling fanboy companion, we at WrestleMania time, we do our WrestleMania marathon and we do different themes on it each
year.
You
organize a race. Yes. It's you and Nick Duke running for charity, right?
Running for charity, representing different WrestleManias.
For instance, I might represent WrestleMania 2 and he 9 or something along those lines. But nonetheless, and then sometimes we do our marathon watch sessions of like takeover, of like SummerSlam or whatever. Well, this year for SummerSlam, rather than do our usual, I stay at his house for a few days and we watch a bunch of SummerSlams or SummerSlam matches, we're going to do takeovers. And we're going to try to watch all the takeovers that we can over the course of because I'll be there for about a week. So we may actually have time to get through most of the takeovers. And then we thought about even bringing back a special HTF episode discussing the history of takeover and our general observations on that time period. So will we actually follow through with it? Probably not, but there's a possibility we may. And if we do, then I certainly invite everyone to listen over at the Lillo Podcast Network to the Hard Traveling Fanboys, should we choose to return.
Well, whether you do or you don't, you heard it here first.
That's right. And a lot of good wrestling at takeovers. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
there is. Now, Jenny, you and I do some shows together on your podcast network that is called The Jenny Position. Mm-hmm. Some of those include the returned now Talking Pop, where we sit down, interview a guest. Greg, you have been a past guest. We've got someone who is very near and dear to our heart coming up. I'd say about 2 weeks from now, from the time you're hearing this, I'm guessing, someone who has kind of been chomping on the bit to be on the show, and we just haven't really, you know, the show was on a hiatus for a minute there, so for one reason or another, haven't gotten to them yet, but you must understand, we have a long line, quite the queue here for Talking Pop, but don't worry, hotly anticipated, that will be coming soon. We also do the Journey Through Infinity, you, me, JT Rosero, and Scott Criscolo. Those are chronological reviews, retrospectives on the MCU films. So we're more than midway through that journey of what's been released to date. We talked Spider-Man Homecoming, I believe, most recently. And we try to get that in when we can. So looking to watch the next film here soon as we are able to. So that should do it for me. Jenny can tell you about more great content on the Jenny Position, I'm sure. If you want to hit me up on Twitter, I am at Cyke68, C-Y-K-E-6-8. Best social media presence for me.
As if that's not enough shit to listen to.
I know.
Let me add a couple of things. My feed is called The Jenny Position, like you said, and there's a new episode, if you heard about Pluto, right now with me and Peter Winston talking about family ties and a really fun double live watch. And a new episode of Geek and Sassy, our 50th episode, finally. And we gather again to...
Congrats.
Thank you. It's a long time coming, but we made it.
What a milestone, yeah.
That is the first show I ever started, and I'm just now on 50 on that. But we talked a bunch of different books and TV shows and podcasts and had our usual fun, so listen to that. And me and Vanessa are back again with Hot Tokes very soon. Talking about the risks of marijuana, because we can't just talk about the fun stuff. We talk a little bit about the downsides. So check that one out when it drops as well. Find me on Twitter at Jenny Position, Facebook page. You can leave reviews. That would be great on any of those podcatchers. And that's all I got. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time with Stunning Steve Austin. I almost called him Stunning Stone Cold Steve.
Stunning Stone Cold Steve Cold Stone Austin.
Cold Stone.
You can say my name right.